This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Kate Mildenhall, every time I see you the last couple of weeks, you tell me your book is going to print. I'm starting to not believe you.
I thought you were about to say, because I was keenly aware as we started recording that I'm wearing the same yellow jumper, and I thought you were about to call me out for wearing the same yellow jumper and sitting in exactly the same spot. But yes, today it is, who knows, it's actually going to print. I even said, where is it going to print and can I go and see it? But apparently it's in South Australia, so I can't go and see it right now.
Well, Megan Rogers, Hard as a Star, went and saw hers go to print. I don't know where that was. Maybe that was in South Australia.
Maybe. I don't know. We'll have to ask her next time. But, yeah, wouldn't it be cool just to see it?
That would be super cool.
Oh, my gosh, there are all those words that nearly broke my brain and they're on big rolls of paper and they're being cut up and glued and stuff. Anyway, apparently the proofreader only found three errors, and that's good, apparently. So off it goes. That's all very exciting. Ace.
On the idea of going to the printer, did you ever go to the Cadbury chocolate factory?
I don't think so. Is that the one where no one eats chocolate again because it smells terrible?
Well, I didn't have that experience. I had more the experience of eating so much chocolate that that you had to have a bit of time off chocolate afterwards. But as a kid, it was incredible. Like,
is there a Willy Wonka vibe? Like, are they experimenting?
No, it's not got a Willy Wonka vibe. It's more the fact that I think I was probably 10 and maybe there are, I don't know, 20 different places in the factory that you go to, and each time they just bring out this big bowl or whatever of offcuts of cherry ripe, or cherry ripe's probably not Cadbury, but whatever it is, and you just consume so much chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty spectacular.
I feel like I have to mention that my last factory visit experience was the abattoir, and that I did not have the experience of wanting to consume much more. Although having said that,
interesting aftermath, because that was during a writer's group retreat. It was. And I remember you kind of came back high and then had a low.
I came back home and then we did go to the pub and I did order brisket. So that was a little bit odd. But then the next day I couldn't get out of bed. So odd. Odd the things we do to write our books.
2 months to go. What are you doing?
What am I doing? Partly I'm really enjoying not having to write or edit The Hummingbird Effect every day. That has been nice. Like, I have got some more kind of socks. Do you have the basket of random socks in your house somewhere? Yeah, I see from your face. Remember, we are an audio medium. Catherine is shaking her head and sighing. That I have attempted to kind of address some sock issues. I've got some life admin done, you know, gone back through the emails. That's all been good. Yesterday, I don't know if you do this when you start a new project. So yesterday I started on the new novel, like the one that will come after, maybe, who knows. But in here where I write at home, it's still very much the Hummingbird Effect everywhere. So I've still got stuff up on the wall that's on my list today to get down. So I was like, right, what I need is to fully shift this. Like, I've got some notes and stuff, but I hadn't actually kind of started the document. So I was like, I'm going to go to the library. And I thought, not only am I going to go to the library, I'm going to catch the train to the library so that there's a bit of a walk. There's the train journey. This is like a physical moving of my body to start a new thing. I felt so smug and pleased with myself. I packed my little lunch. I made sure I had my lead, get down to my library, and it's closed for refurbishment for a month. Anyway, I sat in the cafe instead and I started on the new book. So that is what I'm doing in this in this funny time. And Amy Taylor, actually, who we featured last episode, she talked about getting that advice to use the period before the book comes out to start writing. And I actually reckon it's very generative for me at this time, because I'm not feeling the crush of, you know, bad reviews or anything yet. It's just all excitement. So yeah, so that feels good. That's
the crush of bad reviews, the high of great reviews. I do find the starting of something new difficult, though, I must say. I reckon I love the idea of starting it immediately prior, but I don't know. I find it hard to get the tail of a book out of my head. Do you find that?
Yeah, that's interesting. What I am trying this time is to take a very different approach to planning. You know, I'm not a great planner, and so I'm really trying to plan this one out. Interestingly, I just posted about writing retreats and residencies on my newsletter and also on Instagram. And Michelle Prack, who we've spoken to before, author of The Rush, said that she plans using PowerPoint.
Oh, I get that. Yeah. That's actually, I can see how that would work really
well. That's a revelation to me. I might try that.
Yeah.
You know how I
think that's great, actually. This sounds dumb. I do speeches in PowerPoint, but I will do speeches in PowerPoint and then not use the slides. It's just such a good, like,
structural.
Structural device and flow kind of.
I love that. I'm going to try it.
I do like that. That's a good concept.
Yeah. You've done funny things with PowerPoint before. You did a PowerPoint for your newsletter.
Yeah. Great failure. Something that absolutely did not work.
For you or for readers?
Well, it was the marriage between PowerPoint and Substack was not.
Yeah, right.
That didn't work.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Asked what I was doing, and on Substack, one of the things that I did do is sat down with the amazing Jill, who helped sort me out, and kind of worked back and worked out, okay, actually, how many weeks do I have taking out the 15 days that I run away to Bali with 150 people? It's not that many, but it feels like that. You know, and then kind of planning, okay, well, if this is the stuff that I want to, you know, talk about, or these are all the pictures that are still up on my wall that I wanted to, you know, show, how actually am I going to do that? And having a kind of I'm not a scheduler of social media things. I tried those apps, whatever they are, the platforms, and they've never worked for me. But just having like a list on the whiteboard of going, okay, these I want to talk about, you know, how the outlining document or doing writing residencies or whatever, that has been super helpful to actually.
Journal. I want to hear more about the journaling.
About my journal. It's so big again. I haven't actually properly gone through it, because what I've done in the past, what I did for the Motherfold is, so this is the journal that I keep to document the whole process. So this one's at about 180,000 words. And I went back through the Motherfold one before publication and pulled out various things that I'd forgotten about, you know, like crazy research moments or times when I'd made big changes in the plot or for character. And then I could use them as kind of anecdotes when you have to go and start talking about the book. So I am yet to do that. I did, though, when I was going back through to try and find pictures of writing residencies, I did find the video that I took, which maybe I shall share at some point, except that it's got ugly crying in it. And you know how, like, we're trying to be all authentic on social media, but your authentic is also, do I look kind of like reasonably good in that picture? And it's when Eva sent through her kind of first take on the diagram that's in the middle of the book. And so I'm waiting because it's taking ages to upload, and I'm getting more and more worked up and excited. And then it arrives, and then I just ugly cry. And I kept videoing it. So I have that again.
Show it. Profile, do it.
Use it or not.
Can't you put a filter on it? Would that work? Or you have to do the filter at time of?
I don't know if a filter will actually make this any better. On videos, though, and what I will not be posting, I must check back in, because my daughters reminded me of this last night when they were like, Mum, some kids from school have followed you on TikTok, but there's nothing there. And I'm like, yes, good point. Must tell and admit to the first time listeners, TikTok has not worked for me. I don't want to be on there. I don't want to watch it. I can't work out how to use it. I think it's just not for me. It's not for me. So thank you if you've followed me on there. That's great. Yes, you won't have found anything there.
is it so different to Instagram? Or do you just find the content as a consumer less fun?
I just realized there's not enough space in my brain to learn particular thing. I like learning new things. And I would like to keep doing that, but TikTok, I don't think is the place to learn it for me right now. Happy for people to come at me and tell me that I'm being a fool. But for me, I'm like, that's one step too many on my plate.
Are you off Twitter?
That is a good question. I have moved, I think, I don't know if we mentioned this in the podcast, we've moved the podcast Twitter to be like an updates and news only. Amy Kaufman was telling me about this. I can't remember if this was off air or in the interview, saying that she had done this a couple of years back, just changed her Twitter account to be, this is just news and updates and I'm not, you know, on here. You can find me on Instagram or via my website or newsletter. And so I've kind of shifted to that. So I've put some updates. I will change the banner at the top when, you know, I've got a new one for the new book. But I'm not scrolling on there. Yeah. And that has been good for my health.
Yeah.
Also, I was missing people. So many people left, rightly so, because of masks.
Yes.
That it felt like it didn't have the same, it was like going to a party where half the people didn't show up, you know? It was a little bit disappointing. So, yeah, not there.
Thank God Anna Spargo Ryan is still on Twitter. Well, no, I updated about, I would say, 2 years ago, saying I'm only here to look at Real Housewives-related tweets.
Yeah.
And I think I stick to that. Occasionally I'll scroll down some sort of rabbit hole, but I'm even thinking, and I don't mind that because I guess there's a bit of general interest there, but I'm even thinking maybe I should get off Instagram. I just think there's better uses of time.
There are absolutely better uses of time, but how would I find out half the things I know?
Yes, that's Instagram? Right. That's right. Yeah, but I don't know what the answer is. I think I'm realizing that, say, I do 5 things in life, I can't do them all very well. So I can probably only do 3 things.
Yeah, that is so true.
You know, and maybe I need to do them better. But
Point of interest, are the Real Housewives content people still on Twitter? Do you still get good?
Oh, yes. Okay, yes. Great. There's like the kind of the post-game analysis on Twitter is where it's at. But I don't know. Maybe I'm getting, we'll see. Maybe, well, look, Real Housewives goes in phases. I'm going to say that I'm getting out of Real Housewives. But depending on which, the Real Housewives is this whole world and you focus in on a particular city and then you move to another city. Uh-huh. I'm not so into the mix of cities at the moment. So maybe I'll let it all wane. Who knows?
Let's go straight into watching then. What have you been watching instead?
Nothing. I haven't been watching anything. I have had a cracker of a week book-wise, though.
Oh, go.
I can tell you about 2 books. One is 28 Questions by Indiana Schneider. Have you read this book?
I have read this book, and I got to go on like a little mini tour with her because she's published by the same publisher as I am.
Right. I don't remember talking about it with you. You know, she's an opera singer? Yes, she's an opera singer. She's an opera singer. So 28 Questions came out around the same time as the competition, I think, because I remember going to the Leaf Bookshop and Katie from the Leaf Bookshop was like, oh, Indiana Schneider was just in. Her book's amazing. So I saw it at the library. I just burnt through it. It is so good. It's got a Diana Reid vibe. It's in this early 20s moment at university. It's actually set in Oxford, although Indiana is Australian. She studied in Oxford. She is an opera singer and studied music. So does the main protagonist, has similar characteristics. Just a brilliant book about a friendship that kind of turns into a love affair between two women. Experimentation with form that's really interesting to the extent of including music, which I didn't understand, but I love this idea of the inclusion of music. I still think it adds something, even if I don't understand what those notes mean and what that sounds like. It just really hit for me. Mm. What did you think? Did you?
Yeah, I read it back then when I met Indy, and yes, for me, the thing that stuck out was the form and the experimentation with form. And I was also just so obsessed with the idea that she is an opera singer who just, you know, writes in her spare time. And
it's a knockout debut. Like it is one of these moments where you go, oh, right, you're an opera singer and an incredible author. That seems unfair on some level.
Completely unfair. She, in fact, was incredibly helpful in helping me when I was looking at some stuff for a character in The Hummingbird Effect who has a problem with her voice. And we did a lot of voice messages back and forth as Indy shared all of her incredible knowledge.
Well, it's just interesting the way that she, there's a lot of depth to it. And the characters discuss, you know, I think she calls it university conversation or something like that. They do discuss ideas, which has the potential to be extremely clunky and didactic and not at all fun to read as a reader. But she manages to do it in this really lighthearted and real, but also informative way. So, highly recommend.
Love it. Okay, 28 questions. And what else did you read?
The other one is Everything's Fine by Cecilia Rabess. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right. So she's an American author. This is a really interesting book. It's written from the point of view of a young Black woman who gets a job initially at Goldman Sachs, so a massive kind of banking finance type company. It's set between 2008, so Obama's presidency, and 2016, the start of Trump's presidency. It's basically about this woman who falls in love with a white guy that she works with and she'd previously gone to university with. So it's a bit, I feel like I have to choose my words carefully. It's a bit of a unlikely duo that meet and fall in love. He's not only white, he has very conservative kind of political worldview. She's the opposite. She's also this Black woman in a predominantly white corporate space, which kind of provides an unusual backdrop. What's interesting about it, A, the book is great. It's a romantic comedy, so it's clever and funny, but also incredibly thoughtful. I have never read a book that portrays microaggressions that are race-related in such an incredible and almost experiential kind of a way. It, when it came out, it got a lot of flack on TikTok related to its blurb. So they had the publisher had written a blurb, and the blurb was offhand in the sense that it sort of talked about the guy being white and maybe he's racist. And it sort of said this as a contrast in a throwaway way, but then that blurb was picked up a lot by TikTok and critiqued. And then she ended up, I think, on Goodreads and things, getting lots of people saying this is it's a fabulous book. I don't know how you could give it less than sort of 4 or 5 stars, but a lot of people putting out 1-star reviews saying this is a terrible book. I haven't actually read it, but offended by this kind of comment around the blurb, which is inconsistent with, you know, the nuance of the story, but really, really interesting book.
Did you go and read its 3-star reviews, Catherine, as is your way that you revealed to us all?
Well, curiously, for her, I was looking at the 1-star reviews. I did go down a bit of a rabbit hole of TikTok. Tough gig, right? Like, debut novel, blurb comes out, that's outside of your control. It's interpreted in a way that is different to the intent of the book and how it was originally conceived, but you can sort of see how that could be tough gig.
That's a really interesting point, and it just makes me think, which I'd love to touch on briefly, this idea of what goes into that copy in media releases, on blurbs and things like that. When I do that work with writers who've got books coming out, the Talking the Talk workshop, one of the things that we talk about is how you have control at this point before your book comes out. You've got control of that story. And it's kind of in a way that I'm talking about how you set up your own boundaries about what you're going to talk about. But it is extraordinary. And I think we talked about this too. Leanne Moriarty brought it up in the interview that we did with her about this idea that, you know, media grabs or things from interviews get picked up and they just roll on and roll on and roll on, and you always get asked about them. That it is important to be really happy with the text that goes out, the copy that goes out around your book, because that is the thing you don't get to explain. That's the thing that gets picked up first.
Yeah. The Helpline originally had a different title that Text had proposed. And I remember a moment where my neighbor was like, so they were wanting to call it something like Jermaine Johnson is here to help. And I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, I can live with that. Don't love it. Okay. And then a neighbor came over and was like, oh, the book, how exciting. What's it called again? And I was like, I don't know. Just because I couldn't even say the name. So then I went back to text and they very kindly changed the name.
But yeah. You got to love it. You got to love it. My reading is in entirely different direction to you this week. I'm still on nonfiction. It's very un-me at the moment, but there's a lot of books to read. The first that I wanted to mention is that I went and bought and read very quickly the Voice to Parliament handbook, that purple book that everyone would have seen that's sold out and been reprinted, I think, a couple of times already. So it's by Thomas Mayo and with Kerry O'Brien, with cartoons by Kathy Wilcox. It's very slim. It's like 100 pages, if that. Like, you can put it in your pocket almost. It's so good. It's really clear. It's obviously, this is Thomas Mayo supports the Voice to Parliament. He's a spokesperson for the Uluru Statement of the Heart. And so it is the Yes campaign book, I suppose, in a way. But the detail in there, A, about the creation of the Uluru Statement of the Heart, the long history of advocacy that led up to that, the logistics of how that came to be, and the kinds of conversations that went into that, the people who went into that. So all of that kind of information, which I'm ashamed to say a lot of that I didn't know. And then there's a whole section as well on constitutional change and what it means. It's in very plain, accessible language. It goes on then to have a frequently asked questions section. So all the kinds of questions that have been brought up in the media and different people kind of scaremongering are in there as well. There's cartoons in it by Kathy Wilcox. It's just a very useful kind of book to feel like you know what you're talking about. Because I think, I don't know if you've been doing the same, like, you know, you listen to talk back or you read some of the opinion pieces or on social media and you're like, okay, well, hang on, that person that I think's got some really valid points and they're in the no camp. So what do I, but so is Dutton. And I like, what do I think about this? This just absolutely kind of set my head straight. And I went, okay, now I can talk about this. And interestingly, one of the things at the end is this very short chapter on like what you can do to help. And one of the things they say is you've got to be prepared if you're going to wear a yes on your t-shirt or you're going to, you know, read the book or you're going to have an opinion on this, which we all need to have if we're over 18, because it's, we have to vote if you're an Australian citizen in the referendum, is that you need to be prepared to answer questions and to talk about it. And actually when I posted it on Facebook, someone responded that they were really put off by the subtitle of the book, which is All the Detail You Need. And they commented that the all was putting them off. Mm-hmm. And I kind of left it for a minute. I was like, oh, I don't know how to respond to that. And then I was like, no, what we've been asked to do is to be able to respond and engage in the conversations. As an ally, that's what, you know, I got to do some of the work here. And so I kind of responded and talked about what I'd found useful about the book. And then the person said that they would go and try and find a copy. So I felt like, okay, this is a bit of work that we have to do to try and make sure that we can get the yes vote up, which is what Thomas Mayo is asking us to do. And so that, highly recommend if you can get a copy, because it is sold out everywhere, but I think they're reprinting. So that's my first. And my second, and we've got a interview coming up with the author of this book in a featured segment, but I finished reading A Real Piece of Work by Erin Riley last night and I was so blown away by it, and I had such a response that I just had to reach out and message them and just say what an extraordinary book it is. So this is a debut. It's a collection of stories or essays by Erin Riley, who is a social worker and a counsellor and won the Penguin Random House 2021 Writer Fellowship Program. It's such an extraordinary book. It's about lots of things. It's about Erin's work as a community outreach worker, which really struck home for me because it's so many of the conversations and experiences that Adam and I have. So my partner's a psych nurse who does community outreach work. So there was lots in there that was extraordinarily useful and illuminating for me, in which I immediately, like this morning, went, Adam, you've got to read all this. This is extraordinary. Erin's got both the experiential work in that industry, but also has thought really deeply about it. So it's not kind of heavy academic, but there's references and lots of just really interesting ideas. It's also about Erin's experience of transition, of being queer, of their queer community, of their relationship, of their experiences with family. And it's just, I was thinking, it's so generous the way they have written it, so that readers, especially readers who aren't part of that community, can get this real sense of the joys and also the complications and difficulties of getting about in this world that is not set up at this point for the queer community very well. And I just thought it was extraordinarily generous as a book. So I'm really looking forward to speaking to Erin, and I don't even think that it's out yet, but I highly recommend you put it on your list. Just, yeah, very, very generous piece of work.
Generous is a great word for that.
I think sometimes we, especially in these memoirs, maybe it's the same about Ali Collier's as well, is that like the use of language, it's like being given an inside view where you're like, okay, I feel safe here. I'm not stuffing anything up because I'm not asking stupid questions, and I'm not, you know, asking other people to do the labor because this labor's already been done and we're being invited into it. And I just, yeah.
I felt that way about Everything's Fine by Cecilia Rabas. Like this microaggression thing is so, to hear about that in an academic sense is one thing, but to be in this book and this, like it's an established thing about books, you know, this creating of empathy, but it really struck me in a different way in that it was very current and it just is death by a thousand cuts. Like it's enduring. It's enduring as a, you feel the enduringness of it as a reader.
Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by HarperCollins, and we are delighted to be talking to Aisha Inoon about her debut novel, Untethered. Aisha Inoon is a Sri Lankan Australian writer with a unique cultural perspective, which she brings to her writing. Born in Colombo, she travelled widely and worked as a journalist in Sri Lanka before immigrating to Australia in 2013. Winner of the ASA HQ Commercial Fiction Prize in 2022, her debut novel, Untethered, is partly based on her experiences as an immigrant Muslim woman. Aisha was a recipient of the inaugural 2019 Penguin Random House Write It Fellowship for an early draft of this novel. In 2020, she was selected for the Rosie Scott Writing Residency in New South Wales, and in September 2022, she was awarded a KSP Fellowship by the Catherine Susanna Pritchard Writers Centre in WA to work on her second novel. Her feature articles have been published by SBS Australia, The Sunday Times Sri Lanka, Serendib, and Explore Sri Lanka. Aisha lives in Canberra with her two children. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, and congratulations on your debut novel.
Thanks, Kate. It's very exciting to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So to begin, as we do with everyone on our featured book segment, Aisha, can you please give us the elevator pitch for Untethered?
Sure. So Untethered is a novel about the complex experience of immigration and what it means to look for a better life in another country. And at the same time, it's a story about this young woman who faces and overcomes many challenges to find a more strong and free version of herself. So the main character is Zia. She's a young Muslim woman who's grown up in a very traditional family in Colombo in Sri Lanka. Zia has these dreams of going to university and traveling, but because she knows that her way of life won't allow for that, she does what's expected of her and agrees to an arranged marriage to Rashid. Zia and Rashid have a very comfortable and sheltered life in Colombo. They are wealthy, they're surrounded by friends and family, but still when there's political unrest in Sri Lanka, like many others, they choose to immigrate in search of what they hope will be a better life and a better future for themselves and their daughter, Farah. In Australia, however, things don't turn out quite as they expect. They face a host of challenges from isolation and homesickness to poverty. Rashid struggles to find a job to match his skills. Their relationship is affected. Despite all this, Zia finds that there is a certain freedom in being in a new country and free of the cultural boundaries that she's always been surrounded by. And so in the midst of the challenges, she sets out to find out who she might become in this new world that she's in.
Mm, thank you. Aisha, the blurb for the book indicates that this novel is in part based on your own experiences. Can you just tell us a little how you began writing this book and how the seed went from an idea to a manuscript?
Sure. So I've had Zia in my mind for a long time, even from back when I was in Colombo. And I'd always, like, she'd always come to me in that, the way she appears in that scene the night before her wedding, where she's sitting on the floor, she's looking at the henna patterns on her hands, and she's full of hopes and dreams, but also fears for her future. And I always knew that I was going to write a story about this woman. And then I immigrated to Australia, and I had these really complex experiences myself. You know, we had left friends and family and home, community, established careers, all those things that you tend to take for granted when you're living in a place you call home. Mm. And yes, you do immigrate in search of a better life and a better future. But once you get here, you kind of start to think about what that better life actually means.
Mm.
And then I also had my own experience of being free of like certain cultural boundaries and societal expectations that I'd always known. And that was incredibly liberating in a way, but it was also quite frightening and very much out of my comfort zone. And so I took this character that I'd always had in my mind and sort of started exploring these emotional experiences through her, I suppose. So yeah, that's how I started writing the book.
As a reader without an experience of migration, this lands in a particular way when you're reading it, that this idea that, yes, you know, the incredible experience of home and Colombo and leaving what is, as you say, a life of wealth for Zia and Rashid. And, you know, Rashid in particular has this very established career, and then to arrive in Canberra and he ends up, you know, working these night shifts as a cleaner, like there's a lot of rage and frustration that I felt as a reader. And I imagine that it lands very different for readers who have an experience of migration as well. So I'm wondering how you hold both those different readers in your mind as you're writing as well, because they're coming with very different lived experiences to the experience of reading your book.
That's right. And I suppose I had both these people in my life when I was writing. I knew other immigrants who you'd talk to them and they had very much had a similar experience. And we would have these conversations around, so why did we really migrate? Like, you know, we had these good lives, and yes, there are things we left because maybe home was not feeling safe, or we thought we'd have a better quality of life elsewhere. But then you get here and you start to think about the things you left behind. And also I would I would meet people who, you know, like you said, not had the experience of immigrating. And I think there was sometimes this sense of, or you must have come from real hardship and you must be really relieved to be here in Australia. And I would kind of have to explain that, no, not quite. We did have good lives back home. And yes, there were reasons that we left, but it's, you know, much, much more complex than that. So I suppose I was holding both these audiences in my mind as I wrote. And I hope that, you know, to the reader who was an immigrant, they would be able to relate. And to the reader who wasn't, that they would get a new perspective on what it was like to be an immigrant.
One of the beautiful kind of structural plays that you do in the book is to include a fairy tale that Zia has written, and its placement and its tone and what it reveals are just so beautifully done. I wanted to ask, was this aspect of the novel in there from the beginning?
Well, I suppose that was me giving up a bit of myself as a writer to Zia, because I write to make sense of my world and to make sense of my experiences. And I suppose I thought that that was something powerful that Zia could do for herself when she was in this place where she was struggling to make sense of her world. And that fairy tale was actually written separately to the novel. And then I thought, okay, here's something that maybe I can give to Zia and include in the novel as part of this story.
Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful. I thought that it worked so well. Talking about how the novel was written, you received some really wonderful prizes, accolades, and residencies to work on this book. Can you tell us a little about how these opportunities helped you to write and finish the novel and then find a home for it with a publisher?
Yeah, definitely. That's an interesting story, actually, because I'd started writing this novel in 2018. And I was writing quite slowly. I hadn't got very far. And in 2019, a friend sent me this link to this fellowship being offered by Penguin Random House. And at the time, I had only maybe 10,000 words. And I said, no, I can't like apply for this. And she said, no, just go ahead. So I submitted the few chapters that I had. And a couple of months later, heard that I'd been shortlisted, and they said, we want your complete manuscript in 3 weeks.
So had I rang my friend.
I had like maybe a couple more thousand words. And I rang my friend and I said, I'm so sad, like I can't, like they've shortlisted me and I don't have a full manuscript. And she said, oh, you can write a manuscript in 3 weeks, like just do it. So I think I Googled what's the shortest novel ever written. And I came up with something like, okay, if I write 40,000 words, this will get over the line. So yep. That was my goal. And I just put my head down and wrote for those 3 weeks.
Wow.
And so that's the story of how the first draft came into being. And then to my great surprise, I won the fellowship. And then over the course of the next year, I worked with a mentoring editor, which was really an amazing experience. So, of course, there were many rewrites. Not everything in the first draft made it to the final draft. It grew to 80,000 words. And over that year, I had a complete manuscript. And then the submission process started. So a contract wasn't a part of the fellowship. And so, yes, I did go through the process of submitting and getting rejected and tweaking. And then I applied for the ASA HQ Unpublished Manuscript Award. And again, didn't have much hope by then because I'd had so many rejections. And I suppose publishing is so subjective and unpredictable. And often people would say, you know, like, oh, this is really good, but not quite for us. So yeah, I didn't have much hope. And when I got the call from the Australian Society of Authors initially to say I'd been shortlisted, for a moment I was like, what have I been shortlisted for? I can't remember, because I'd been submitting everywhere, so many things. But yeah, and after a couple of weeks heard that I won, it was absolutely a dream come true moment. I've been wanting to be a published author since I was a child. And yeah, I'm very, very excited.
Oh, that's such a great story. When you were speaking then, I was reminded of something that I think someone told me at one point and what we've said to other people on the podcast, which is, in the midst of all the rejections, you only need one yes.
I know.
You just need that one yes.
That's right. And so I think it is, like, yes, hard work and good writing, but also a little bit of luck, like the right person picking up the manuscript and loving it.
Absolutely. You mentioned then that you've wanted to be a writer since you're a child, and I know that your background is in journalism.
Yes.
What kind of skills did you bring across from your journalism to this writing of fiction? I imagine that the fact that you could write kind of 30,000 words in 3 weeks yes. is something to do with being able to meet deadlines. So what kind of skills did you bring across?
Yeah, that's an interesting question too, because as a journalist, I was mainly a feature writer. I wasn't, I think I'd written a couple of news pieces, but feature writing was my forte. And often my editor's main criticism of my writing would be that, oh, you brought out the emotions so well, but where are the facts? So I think I might be a better fiction writer than I was a journalist, but I think I did learn as a journalist to write factually, but also to really like listen to people's stories and to translate that into a narrative that a reader would be able to read and understand and appreciate. And I think that is sort of what I was doing in fiction, not just my own emotional experience, but talking to other immigrants, as particularly women, and like translating that into writing. And you're very right, being able to meet a deadline. I think that's the way I write best, if I've got a deadline hanging over me.
You have already begun work on a second novel. Is that taking you in a very different direction? And is the process different to you now that you have written one novel already and kind of known that you can finish it? Is the process any different?
Yeah, sometimes I think I don't know why I said that in my bio, because now it's like in writing and I have to do it. But of course, you know, I would write whether or not I get published. And so I'm kind of doing the same thing where I have these, in this case, three particular characters in my mind. And you know how Stephen King says you put characters in a difficult situation and then you see what happens. And that's sort of my preferred way of writing a story as well. I am finding it a bit, you know, it's not like writing your debut novel where it's just you and the manuscript alone in the dark and you're writing and no one really knows or cares. So I do feel that pressure a little bit. But I try and put that aside and do what I've always done in terms of writing, because I love to write and because I have a story that I want to discover and tell.
Today, when I'm speaking to you, you're still a couple of weeks off publication day. So you're just in that kind of bit where you're doing a little bit of media and recordings and things like that. What are you most looking forward to about the kind of publication experience?
This just been such an amazing ride. Like the publishers have been so supportive. Friends and family have been so excited. I think I'm just really looking forward to how readers respond to this book. Just, you know, people that I don't know. I have had a little bit of that already from early readers and it's been wonderful. But I suppose that's like every writer wants an audience. You want people to read and understand and like appreciate your story and sort of take what they want from it. So I'm really both curious and excited to see how readers will respond to that story.
Aisha, can you give us some advice and our listeners some advice, perhaps some advice that you received or some advice, something that you've come to learn about the writing process that you can share with us?
I think my advice is the advice that I give myself as well, is to be true to your story and to write the story that's in your heart. Whether a publisher will pick it up or not is irrelevant when you're actually writing. I think write in a way that you fall in love with your story, and that's what makes readers fall in love with your story.
Can you give us, please, a debut book recommendation, any time or any genre?
Yeah, so many great books, right? I thought a bit about this one, and I think one of the best debut novels that I read in the past year was Tracy Lehan's All That's Left Unsaid. It's this amazing novel that somehow manages to combine the suspense of a murder mystery, deep emotional family drama, and also again themes of immigration and identity and what it means to belong somewhere. Really enjoyed it.
Aisha, you have got your launch coming up. Can people find you via the HarperCollins webpage? Are you on social media? Where can people find you?
I am on social media, so just at my name, at Aisha Noon on Facebook and Instagram. And Twitter, wherever they choose to follow me. And there's details about my upcoming book launch there, and love to see anyone who'd be interested.
Congratulations again on Untethered. It's such a wonderful read. Enormous congratulations to you and good luck for the launch and everything that's coming your way and the writing of the second book. It's been great to talk to you, Aisha.
Thank you, Kate.
I've been watching a lot of television.
Oh, tell me. All I actually want to do is watch TV. I just want to lie in bed with blankets on.
Let me tell you, a quick callback to the last time we spoke, I had not yet watched the last episode of The Last of Us, season one. I have now. It was great. I really enjoyed it. And I was listening to, so I'm not a Succession fan, as in not that I don't like it. I've never watched a single episode. It's one of those things like you talking about, do I need to get off Instagram? Like I kind of do the maths in my head. I'm like, there's however many seasons I've got to go back. Do I have time for this in my life right now?
Mm.
And I don't feel like I do. So I'm not a Succession fan, but I was very interested in the kind of general conversation around how the last episode was going to go. And I listened to ABC Radio to Raff Epstein was interviewing Michael Shulman, I think his name is, who's a writer for The New Yorker, a big Succession fan. Raff talked to him just before the episode was airing in the US and was kind of framing the conversation and also talk back callers were calling in about how to land an ending, especially at the end a series, the end of a season series. And they were kind of talking about really bad ones. Game of Thrones was an example. Lost was an example where the ending just did not land. And I'm so into it because I think narratively, whatever business of narrative we're in, whether we're screenwriters or making television or making books, that idea of how you land everything in the ending so that the reader viewer is satisfied, surprised, everything comes home, but it doesn't come home in a way that's too much. It's just, I want to know that maths so well.
I'm thinking of two TV series. One is The Office and the other is Seinfeld. Seinfeld ended like, I think they did 9 seasons of it and people were very much left wanting more. But I never really felt like they actually landed the end. Yes. They just finished with at the right time.
Yes.
And The Office, I feel like, is the opposite. Like they had 9 seasons as well. Steve Carell, who was sort of the star of the show, left at season 7. So they had these two sort of seasons that weren't great, but they landed the ending.
Yes. See? Endings. Maybe I just need to go back and watch a lot of endings. One more. So let me set this up in that my daughters regularly watch kind of series that I have no interest in. The other day, I can't remember where we were coming home from. It was a long trip. They were both watching something on the phone. I started listening. I was like, oh, I'm not sure. Is that appropriate? Like, what are you watching? And they were like, it's Never Have I Ever, Mum. It's fine. But it was a whole thing about someone wanting to have sex. And I was like, okay, well, just like, I'll watch it with you. Anyway, so then they invite me to sit down and watch it with you. And I am in. This morning before school, we especially made time to watch the last episode of season 1. So I think the 4th season is about
to drop. This is Mindy Kaling's show, right?
Yes. Yeah. Have you watched it?
I haven't watched it. No, but you're selling me on it.
Oh, I am so in. So I have to say, because I went back through and looked at some reviews, and some of them are saying like, the first 3 episodes, you know, were a bit wobbly and then it hit strides. I didn't actually start watching until like the 4th episode of the first season, but I am in. So the setup is Indian American girl in the US, starting her sophomore year. She has a list of things that she wants to do, include kind of snagging the hot guy. She's the brainy one. Her father has died tragically 8 months earlier, and that's the kind of underlying trauma that she's going through. Great cast, very funny. It's diverse. It's interesting. It's kind of, when I started watching, I was like, oh, this is like Sex Education, but for a younger audience that really works. And I loved Sex Education. But by the time we finished this morning, I was weeping. I was like waiting for the kiss at the same kind of hype level as my daughters were. And it reminded me so much of how my friends and I, or my sister and I particularly, used to watch Dawson's Creek. Like just that
Oh my God.
Totally full body in. I felt like a 14-year-old when I was watching today. I was all in. The mum in particular is just brilliant. Like I didn't write down the actor's name, but she's brilliant. So many great lines in it. I am in. It's what I'm now watching the next two seasons with my girls. There was like that kind of, I've got to go to basketball training, but you two are not allowed to watch until I get back. So yeah.
You've sold me. You've completely sold me. Also just the sharing of watching. We watch so much, or I probably watch predominantly alone. And we did a similar thing with Lego Masters recently. It's really fun watching TV with other people.
It's really fun. And the reminder that you have to remind your children that this is what you always used to do. There's one that I didn't put down. So my youngest and I went on a date on Saturday night to watch The Little Mermaid. Have you watched it yet?
No. Is this something at the cinema?
Yeah, at the cinema. Like, I highly recommend going for the cinema experience just because it is so kind of spectacular on the screen. Like, what they've done for the under the water world and the sea creatures and everything, like, it's spectacular to watch. But it was also like, she was so into it. My youngest is so into it, but she admitted that she has never seen the animated one. Like, she knows The Little Mermaid because it's so in our popular culture. But my sister and I remember this very clearly, once borrowed it, probably when it was new to Weekly, when it was a little bit less expensive from, what was the name of the play? Blockbuster. Yeah, from Blockbuster. Or Elson Video. We just had an indie in Elson. It was great. And we watched it 7 times in one day. It might have been school holiday. I don't know what it was. Maybe we were sick, but 7 times. We probably made the, you know, when the VHS tapes used to kind of stretch and go wobbly, I think we made it happen. So I know literally every word. I can sing all the songs. It is such a cleverly done remake. There's people saying much cleverer things than I. The Beverly Wang and Ben Law on Stop Everything have a great episode about this.
Incredible. I didn't realize it wasn't a I assumed the new one was animated.
No, it is not. I mean, there is some clearly amazing things because the real people are mermaids. So, and the seagull talks and so does Solander, but it's a fish. It's brilliantly done, but the cast are brilliant. Very Ursula. Oh my gosh. Melissa McCarthy does Ursula and she's incredible. Oh, amazing. Just really worth it. I loved it.
On the topic of indie video shops, do you remember the porn section in video shops? Like, that is a moment in time, isn't it? Ours had like the normal section and then there was this sort of dark space.
Well, let me tell you, you know how you always really enjoy the things where you're like, I did not know that about UK Milton Hall, is that I once, for research purposes, when I was in uni, had to go into my local Elfin Video and borrow from the porn section publicly because I was doing a unit of work at RMIT. There was those ones where you could like do something from another area, like to make you more kind of culturally across things.
Yeah.
And I did a history of sex, which was quite an extraordinary kind of a subject. Very well attended lectures, I must say. we like did the Marquis de Sade. We did like history of prostitution. Like it was extraordinary. But one of the things you had to do was watch all these classic
porn films.
Which I went and borrowed with a friend, and it was very amusing. And they did offer me to take them in a plastic bag rather than walk out with a stack. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great subject. That's my porn story.
I remember my mum sitting next to someone on a plane once who was reading a porn magazine. Is what they call the porn, like
a magazine
on the plane.
Yeah,
it's kind of a weird thing to do.
It's quite intimate, I would say. Probably not. I mean, you can read your erotica on your Kindle. Go for it. But like the visual probably is a bit too much.
Yeah, a bit too much. I've got one listening recommendation.
Please.
It is How Other Dads Dad by Hamish Blake. Had you heard of this?
No.
So obviously I'm not a dad, but I reckon it applies equally to mums or parents as well. I'd heard about it ages ago. It'd been sitting on my podcast app, but I think because we were watching Lego Masters, Hamish Blake was in my mind. The first interview, it's really good. It's just a really nice, it's a limited series. It came out December-ish last year. The first interview he does is with Rob Sitch, who I nice. Have always loved, Rob Sitch. So just a perfect conversation. The one with Stan Grant is also really interesting. But the one with Rob Sitch, they sort of talk about parenting and stuff. But one of the things that they talked to, which I really, really liked, was about having fun and putting a lot of effort into fun. And I think in parenting, that's often the thing that goes by the wayside because fun is effort.
Yeah.
But they had some great examples of fun things. And one of the things that Rob Sitch had talked about was getting his kids, who are maybe the eldest is in their early 20s, the youngest would be sort of 12, 13, something like that, getting the kids to pick holiday destinations. Nice. And so they had a suite of different options. Rob and Jane Kennedy had thought, oh, they'll pick Hawaii. But the kids just picked this road trip. They wanted to go to motels that had sliding doors where they provided the breakfast in the morning.
Oh, I love that.
Just talked through these things that kids find fun. And you did find them all fun as a kid, like a buffet.
Oh.
What kid does not absolutely love a buffet? The idea that kids, you know, when you go away, probably prefer a pool at the place than going to the beach every day. Like, very true. So a bunch of fun stuff. But one of the things they mentioned was Rob mentioned Cryle Castle. Have you heard of Cryle Castle?
I have been to Cryle Castle.
I've never been there, but I've been saying to the kids for ages, we should go to Cryle Castle, we should go to Cryle Castle. Anyway, the fact that Rob Sitch mentioned it in this episode, I have now booked for us to stay for 2 nights at Cryle Castle.
I didn't know you could stay there.
You can stay there. So there's a big four caravan park that you can stay in, or there must be the castle area. I went to book and there's this one room set up that is extraordinarily cheap compared to the others. I mean, it's all pretty affordable and budget, but there's one room, it's called the Commander's Quarters, and it sleeps 10 people. And you have one room that's a double bed or a queen size bed. And then you have another room that has 4 bunks. And I couldn't work out why it was so cheap. So that might be $440 a night. Whereas like a cabin for 4 people is 440. So I was like, that's really affordable. Why is it like that? I looked through all the reviews and I think that maybe I've booked. So I booked it, that it has no windows. So I had said to the kids, you know, get excited, you're taking people. But anyway, so they're able to take friends. We'll be staying for 2 nights at Cryle Castle room with many beds and no windows.
I did not think that you were going to say the no windows, because I went as a kid. We haven't taken the kids to Cryle Castle, and I'm sure that this will not spoil your experience, but because my most recent memory of Cryle Castle is that I think that they used to have a lot of kind of raves there. Maybe there wasn't my
Maybe.
Scene.
There was no raves mentioned on the website.
Yeah, raves. And potentially, I don't know what you call those kind of parties, like the one that Sally Hepworth went, invitation only.
Oh, swingers.
In Sydney. I think maybe they have some kind of swing. So I thought you were going to say it was a room set up in particular for many people for other uses, but I'm sure that that is not the thing. And I think like with this episode is going to have a warning in it. Sometimes, you know, those blow up places like bounce
or inflatable world type places.
I'm pretty sure you can book inflatable world after hours for adult type parties. And I think the Cryle Castle has that.
Well, this has, so like to add to the affordability of this. So not only can 10 people fit in this room, which kind of sounds, well, 2 in one room and 8 in the other, there are 2 very strategically taken photos. Like you can't see that much and there's no photo of the bathroom at all. But the general admission to the theme park, we should say this is a medieval theme park that has accommodation.
And we have not very clearly been sponsored for this content.
No.
So we'll probably be sued.
they probably don't have money for sponsorships, is my impression. But you get everyone that stays in the room gets admission to the theme park.
Yeah.
Which would normally cost $100. So, and you're allowed to access the theme park after hours.
I think you have yourself an amazing deal, and I cannot wait for our follow-up conversation.
Will it be fun? I'm not sure.
Maybe you can go on Hamish's podcast.
Do a follow-up. That was proposed as fun and turned out to be quite a lot of effort and not fun. There is a pool at the caravan park portion.
Tick.
So watch this space. Oscar has already invited friends.
You're taking other children without their parents.
I should have said that. Yes. So the plan is that the kids can take two children each.
Two each?
Well, because they always want to have a sleepover, but the house is just too small for a sleepover. So I was like, I'll knock the sleepover Kryle Castle and make excellent use of the 10-bedroom
space. Feel like we need to put a poll out to our listeners to see who they think is more mad, me for going away with 28 people, including 17 children and 15 adults to Bali for a week, or you for going to Kryle Castle for a night with two nights, four of whom are not your own, in a room without windows. Listeners, if you can get back to us and tell us if we're both mad,
bathroom,
or one of us is more mad, and we will come back to you with a follow up on both of these stories. When are you going? I'm
September
having a
holidays.
Panic
attack. First week in the September holidays.
Okay, amazing.
Only time I could get.
Well, I don't know why. We've got a lot of places today. We have to do a thank you to all our patrons via Patreon. As usual, you make things so much easier than you always have done. We have a new patron. It is Lynn Hume, who just happens to be my very delightful auntie. So thank you very much, Lynn, because I didn't know until the Patreon thing came in. So thank you, and to all our patrons. And Catherine, you've got an event coming up.
I do have an event coming up as part of Willy Lit Fest. The event is on Saturday, the 17th of June. It's at 3 p.m. It's part of Willy Lit Fest. And I will be talking to Pip Finkelmeyer about Sad Girl Novel. That is the name of her novel. But we will also be talking about Sad Girl novels in general.
This week on our Instagram over at The First Time Pod, we are handing over to some of the incredible gang who make up the Debut Crew 2023, and we'll be featuring reels from a number of debut authors. We've been so excited and impressed watching this group of debut authors support each other at launches and on socials. They formed themselves. They turn out in numbers to back each other up. They have what I hear is a very active WhatsApp thread, and it's just truly been a delight to watch and hear about their very genuine support for each other. I was chatting to two members, Ali Parker and Karen Comer, at a launch and wanted to do something to support this gang. And this is what we've come up with. It's a very small act of support. We've said before that we wish we could talk to more authors and feature their books in interviews, but Catherine and I are just truly at capacity right now. So these authors have created their own reels, introducing themselves and their books, and you can find them on our Instagram over the next week or so. We'll have another batch of reels from the Debut Crew later in the year. Enjoy. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.